Bloomington takes pride in its historic housing stock, rows of cottages and bungalows densely packed together, with some dating back to the 1800s. Marcy Wentzler's lived in Bloomington for decades and asked WFIU, what's the history of racially restrictive housing covenants here?
I think the main thing that strikes me is that there's so much we don't know, and it's very easy for us not to know.
In their most basic sense, covenants are agreements in a housing deed that the buyer of a property must follow. They can cover anything from how tall the fence is to what color the house is painted, and in the past, who could live there.
I was shocked and surprised at first, and then I just wasn't.
As the Monroe County Recorder, Eric Schmitz comes across the covenants regularly. His office walls are jammed with leather-bound books full of housing deeds. In fact, the covenants were so common, he began a project last year to collect and identify the documents containing racial language.
Sometime in the 20s is the earliest one that I remember that I was able to find.
One local historian has traced the earliest racial covenant back to 1917, when University Courts Realty Company inserted the language in a deed. The real estate, it said, shall, quote, never be rented to a colored person or sold to a colored person, end quote. Today, that area sits off 7th Street, across from Dunn Meadow, not far from where IU professor Eric Sandweiss teaches.
And basically, they thrived, and they helped to define and to determine, especially the way American suburbia looked.
As Bloomington developed, the covenants became widespread. The recorder's office has identified at least 10 plats containing the language in the city's core neighborhoods. Any residences located on the plats would carry those covenants, so the city's number is likely much higher.
I'd have to look at our spreadsheet again. Heaven only knows how many there are in the miscellaneous records.
The racial covenants continued through 1948, when the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional.
It simply said those are unenforceable as contracts. We're not saying you got to get rid of them. We're not saying you got to wipe them out. We're not saying you could sue somebody for trying to put it in there. We're just saying the courts will wash their hands of it.
The language remained in the deeds, and social pressure kept home ownership a primarily white venture.
Social pressure is as significant as legal precedent.
Just ask Ken Thomas, who moved to Bloomington in 1965. Despite having a good job and being a Korean War veteran, he was unable to find a home to buy.
It was awful. And there was one realtor that sticks in my mind. He absolutely told me that he did not have anything a person of color could buy.
He spent his first months in town renting while getting the runaround from local realtors. Until one day, a Jehovah's Witness noticed Thomas's out-of-town license plates, and the two got to talking.
Through conversation, I told him I'd really like to buy a house, but there's no realtor would sell me a house. And he said, well, I'm a builder. He said, if you buy a lot, I'll build you a house.
Others got ahead of the issue before it could become a problem. Gene Devane was friends with a white lawyer who ensured everything went smoothly.
And having grown up in the South and understanding what the rules were, the unwritten rules were, I decided to circumvent that because I heard complaints from those friends of ours who tried to get homes and were not successful with it.
The Fair Housing Act of 1968 put mechanisms in place to ensure equal opportunities in housing, but Bloomington didn't differ much from the rest of the country when it came to racial covenants. For WFIU News, I'm Mitch Legan.